Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
I'm Angie Coro. I host live from the Left Coast on Green 960 and online, and I am your moderator this evening. Tonight, we are here to listen to some amazing but true tales with Inforum's program. Michael Moore, his latest film, Capitalism, A True Story, investigating the powerful forces behind the calamitous predicament in which countless Americans are finding themselves, losing their homes, jobs, and savings to foot the bill for past spending. So, let's open up our ears and our minds and get the fun started. Tonight we host Michael Moore, who's an Academy Award-winning American filmmaker, author, and liberal political commentator. He's the director and producer of Bowling for Columbine, Fahrenheit 9/11, and Sicko, three of the top five highest-grossing documentaries of all time. And his latest film is Capitalism, A True Story. Love story. Did I say that? Okay, I'll leave now. He'll do it. Capitalism. Well, in fact, which is my first question, a love story. Why?
Well, do you have issues with the word love? Is that why you can't say it? I mean, it's not really that kind of show, I know, but...
I guess I just never thought of you as that enamored with capitalism.
You never thought of me making a romantic documentary, right? Well, it is a love story. It's about the wealthy who love their money. Except the movie has a twist. They not only love their money, they love our money too. And they want all of it. So that's kind of where I start. And from there, I have a number of stories that I want to share with the audience. Some stories I've collected along the way in my 20 years as a filmmaker. Our web guy here just reminded me it was 20 years ago today that Roger Me debuted at the Toronto Film Festival and won the top prize there. And so this is kind of a nice little anniversary day for me to be here in San Francisco. So this movie is... It's about all the things I've been thinking about and writing about and filming in these 20 years. It's about greed. It's about the lack of democracy that we have in this country and the lack of power that it seems that the average people have, and yet they actually are supposed to have all the power. So this is kind of a culmination of all of that. And I made this film, actually. I said to the crew the first day, I said, why don't we make this movie as if they are going to pull the plug on us after they see this thing? I mean, the studios, the distributors, the theaters, they're not going to give me another dime to make these movies after they see this one. Our goal with this film should be to put ourselves out of business. They'll be so frightened by this film. And it wasn't really till we were almost done making the film, just back in July, when I got a call from the Bill Moyers show, the producer of the show, saying you might want to turn the TV on in an hour. There's something you might like to see. And so I did, and on the Bill Moyers show was the former vice president of Cigna Health Insurance, Wendell Potter, and he was there to reveal for the first time that the health insurance industry got together, all these competing companies got together in a room and put together a secret plan to smear Michael Moore and the film Sicko. How to tell lies, essentially, about the film and about me. Identify those reporters and critics who will most likely repeat those lies, and have their lobbyists threaten any member of Congress, especially a Democratic member of Congress, Anybody who would dare to support my movie or associate themselves with me, they were to be told that the health industry was going to give them a one-way ticket back home to their district. They were going to be defeated. Now, I'm sitting there watching this in my living room, and I'm thinking, it's just a movie. I mean, what is, I mean, and the intricacy and the documents that he had showing all this of how much effort they put into this because they thought Sicko could be the tipping point where the public would just rise up and demand universal health care, single-payer health care. And as I was in the final 2 weeks of putting this film together, the capitalism film, it sort of buoyed my spirits that actually making movies can matter and cinema can be dangerous. And if they're that worried about it, then maybe they'll really be worried about this film. And so there's the short answer to your question.
You know, which brings up two questions. One is, can you imagine the same sort of organization and zest behind a group that is working hard to take down Glenn Beck? I mean, from the flip side of it, it seems like there's a side that has the evil and the organization all in one pretty package, and then there's us.
Yeah, that's kind of true. I mean, I hate to say it, but I don't know people, liberal-minded people. I suppose if you look up the definition of liberal in the dictionary, it means to be open-minded, to have a liberal mind, to explore, to be open to things. And even with Glenn Beck, as much as people may detest what he does and what he says, and he certainly has said some pretty despicable things about me, on one of his shows, he talked about himself fantasizing about actually killing me and asking himself, could he really do it? And then he decided he could do it. There's no FCC fines for a talk like that, nor is there for Bill O'Reilly, who on a show a few years ago said that he didn't really support the death penalty unless he would make an exception for Michael Moore. So, you know, most people I know don't talk like that. We don't like what they do. We disagree with their policies. We hate this war. But I don't hear a lot of people say that they actually hate this other individual happens to disagree with us politically or try to demonize them. Or worst of all, I guess, what the health industry tried to do to me and Sicko is just simply lie. And this whistleblower, Wendell Potter, he then talks about how he was sent to do the reconnaissance, to come to Michigan, to where the town where I live. I was having a little premiere of the film for the people in the town. And he brought his 14-year-old son, and he was there to take notes and get all the stuff down. This is before the movie was going to open nationwide. And he said as he's sitting there, he essentially had his St. Paul moment. Because he sat there looking at Sicko and saying to himself, as the vice president of one of the biggest and worst health insurance companies in the country, everything I'm seeing is true. I know it to be true. I know the truth about the Canadian healthcare system and how much better it is. I know all of this is true. How can I keep lying? He said at the end of the movie, the lights came up, and everybody filed out of the theater, and I was out in the lobby, and his 14-year-old son saw me and broke away from him, from his dad, and ran over to me because he wanted to get his picture taken with me and get my autograph and shake my hand. And Wendell Potter says, and I stood there, and I looked at that. Here's my own son. He's just watched for 2 hours what I do for a living, which is to essentially cause the deaths of at least 18,000 Americans a year simply because they don't have health insurance. Or if they do have health insurance, everything Cigna and the other companies do to deny care, to kick people off the rolls, or to not even accept them because of a pre-existing condition. And he saw his son shaking my hand, and he just kind of had this moment of realization that he couldn't continue. He couldn't continue on. So I remain hopeful that people on the other side of the fence, whether they're over there because of their conservative or right-wing politics or whether they're there because of their corporatist nature, that I believe all people are good at their core and sometimes get a little misdirected or misguided or believe the propaganda, but all have the ability to turn around and do good. And I've believed that all of my life. You know, I've never uttered the words, I hate George W. Bush. I've never uttered those words. As much as I fought the guy, as much as I hated what he did, I never hated him as a person and still don't to this day. Because, first of all, I don't want to be down on that level. I don't want to go into that gutter that Fox News and Rush Limbaugh exist in. You know, I just if I felt myself going there, I'd want to pull myself up from it. Because I don't want to live like that, and I don't want to live in a world like that, and I don't want to contribute to a world like that. So that's kind of my MO.
Well, so much for that. So much for that just a movie thing. Not just a movie.
Well, I guess so, but that's, hey, what great news for all artists that art and culture, writing, poetry, playwriting, filmmaking, all of these things can contribute to raising people's consciousness, to informing them, to having them connect on a human level to the social condition. And I would encourage any of you who are any of those things to rise up and just really make use of this, what I hope to be an enlightened era. Somebody was asking me earlier today, they said, well, what are you going to do now, Mike? Bush is gone, you know? You're out of work. You're going to have anything to go after? And I said, are you kidding me? Are you kidding? I have waited 8 years for this moment where there's like a breath of fresh air that has blown through the window. And I think, I hope, I feel like I'm going to thrive during this time. Because if Obama becomes what we hoped he would be when we voted for him, those of us who voted for him, and the jury is out, the jury's about ready to come back in. If he becomes what we think he can be, the Roosevelt of the 21st century, you think back to the time of Roosevelt in the last century, and what did the culture provide us then with? Will Rogers, Frank Capra, Preston Sturges, John Steinbeck, John Ford making John Steinbeck's movie, right? I mean, there was a rush of films and books and plays and art that was there in large part to help bring Roosevelt's message to a mass audience and get people thinking about it's okay to stand up for the little guy, for John Doe. And I think and I hope that other artists, filmmakers, people will use this time to bring to the public the important works that they need to see and hear and read. So I'm very optimistic about that piece of it during this Obama era.
You know, I read the interview that you had in Rolling Stone. You were one of three people who were assessing how Obama had done so far, and you sounded very optimistic at the time, and I guess by now I thought that might have, the glitter might be off it a little bit. I mean, the Defense of Marriage Act, nothing happened. Don't Ask, Don't Tell, nothing happened. Public option, not really happening.
Yeah. What I said in this article is that I know a lot of people on the left are worried about Obama at this point. And my sense has been that I think he's a great amateur basketball player. And I think a lot of what he's doing is faking right and going left. I think that's what he's going to do. I think he will go left. I think that what he's inherited is a catastrophe. Two wars, three wars, four wars, really, if you want to get into all that. And the worst economic mess since the Great Depression, and all this has fallen on his shoulders. He's been in office for 8 months, and I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt right now. I'm willing, you know, because I've seen enough to know. Did I ever think I would live to see a president of the United States admit that the United States government overthrew the democratically elected government in Iran back in the 1950s? I mean, when he did that, I'm like, holy smokes, what is going on here? And there's so many other little examples of that that he did especially in the early weeks and months here of his administration. And when he said he wants to close Guantanamo Bay, and he sends a bill up to Congress to fund the closing of it, of the 60 Democratic senators, six vote in favor of that. Six. So he's got a big problem with the Republicans and the sort of, you know, very boisterous, somewhat organized opposition that you're seeing and hearing at town hall meetings and the like. But he's also got a problem with his own party, because he's got a bunch of spineless Democrats in the U.S. Congress who are just I don't know what to say. I would like to root some of them out of there next year in the congressional elections. Because they're going to hold this thing back worse than actually if it was just Republicans we had to deal with. So the shine has not come off it for me. I don't know if it, I mean, yes, 5 months from now, if he's still sending troops to Afghanistan, then as far as I'm concerned, it should no longer be considered Bush's war. It will be known as Obama's war. And I can't believe he wants that on his neck. But I got to tell you, when I went in to vote last November 4th, my wife and I, we went to our little polling station, and I closed the curtain, and in Michigan, you have to color in the circle with a felt pen. And I looked down, and I saw his name, Barack Obama. And I literally started to cry. Did anybody else have that experience? Or was I the only crazy guy in northern Michigan? But I'm serious. I couldn't believe I was actually going to be able to vote for him. And one of my tears fell and dropped right on the spot where I had, and it smeared it. This ink now is a smeared the ballot, and I'm trying to, you know, rub it off and blow, dry it. And I'm going, oh my God. And so I open the curtain and come out, and my wife is standing there looking at me all red eyed, and she says, "Pull it together, man." I said, "I know, I can't help it. It's been 8 years of this. I can't believe what we've gone through." And when I say we, I don't mean the planet. I'm really just talking about me, you know, the ringer that I've been put through because what did I do that was so dastardly wrong? I said that I didn't think there were any weapons of mass destruction over there. I said that I think we're being lied to about this. That's my crime. And I said it on the Oscar stage and got booed off the stage for it. I mean, it was an ugly time, if you remember, back in 03 and 04. And, I was just thinking the other day how Al Franken was in favor of the war. You remember that? You know, so we tend to forget this. Keith Olbermann was in favor of the war. He talked about it even last week on his show about how, at least at the beginning, he was willing to give the president the benefit of the doubt. The editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick, was for the war. Bob and Harvey Weinstein, who were producing my film at the time. I was in the middle of making Fahrenheit 9/11. And I have to listen to them. They were at the time. They're for the war. It was, I got to tell you, it was a lonely time if you were against this war. And many of you probably know that. If you remember back what it was like at work or in the neighborhood or in school or even in your own family. Maybe not so much here in San Francisco, but let me tell you, across the country, to utter anything against this war made you completely unpatriotic, un-American, and perhaps treasonous. And you really weren't doing anything other than doing the most patriotic act you could, which is to stop this country from invading another country illegally and immorally. And my hat's off to everybody who tried to do that before the war started. And, you know, here we are now, 8 years later. The wars continue. We have a new president. I think we expect this president to do the right thing.
We have the same media as we had before, and I couldn't help...
Not for long.
I hope not.
The daily newspapers, we may be in the last year of reading a daily newspaper in print. Seriously, do you realize that? No, I know. It's a bad thing, actually. A democratic society needs a daily newspaper. It needs journalists who are paid a decent salary and do investigative reporting. Unfortunately, we haven't had that. Why have people stopped reading the paper? Why are these papers going under? They'll blame the internet. It's not... I say to them, geez, is that really? So why is it then that the papers in Europe aren't going under? Last I heard, they've got the internet in Germany and Sweden and France. Why aren't they going under? Well, can I take a second and explain my theory about this? First of all, the papers have made themselves irrelevant because they can't be trusted. When the New York Times editorially endorses the war and on its front page has a reporter printing lies to prepare the country, scaring the country, about weapons of mass destruction, do you realize that George W. Bush probably couldn't have pulled off the war had he not been legitimized by the New York Times? It was a genius moment for him that the Times did this. And I think many of us, even though the paper has apologized profusely for their behavior, now read that paper with a very skeptical eye. And it's debilitating when you think about it because we need a New York Times. But I think one of the main reasons why papers are going under is because capitalism has killed them. The greed of these large media companies, they started this back in the late 80s, early 90s. They started laying off reporters, thinking that they could get a smaller group of reporters to do just the same amount of writing. But eventually they canceled beats. And David Simon, the producer of The Wire, used to be a Baltimore Sun reporter, tells the story of how, you know, in Baltimore, the Baltimore Sun, they got rid of the labor reporter, they got rid of the courts reporter, they got rid of the poverty reporter. You know, these are three big things that people in Baltimore care about: labor, poverty, and crime. But if you get rid of the beats, well, why bother reading the newspaper? But they did it because they wanted this short-term profit, short-term gain by getting rid of people, and you'll show a better bottom line at the end. But here's the main reason I think this has happened. We have a nation now of 40 million illiterate, functionally illiterate adults. 40 million adults who cannot read and write above a fourth grade level. And probably another 40 million who can read at a fourth grade level but can't really comprehend it, can't really analyze it and dissect it. How did we get that way? To have so many tens of millions of our fellow citizens semi-literate, illiterate, and ignorant. It's because we have decimated our schools, our public education system. We have wrecked it beyond belief. And the policies of Republican presidents who have dominated the political scene for the last 30 years, I mean, they have a party platform position every convention to dismantle and eliminate the Department of Education. They want as little money spent as possible on education, and if there's one union they'd like to bust, it's the teachers' union. So, in the last 17 presidential elections between 1940 and 2004, the majority of American newspapers endorsed the Republican candidate for president in 14 of those 17 elections between 1940 and 2004. 14 out of 17 times. They endorsed the candidate of the party that was committed to creating a nation of semi-literate people, people who couldn't read and write on a fourth grade level. In other words, your readers, who's going to buy your paper if they can't read it? And the paper started to recognize that the country had really gone illiterate and stupid. And so what did they start to do 10, 15 years ago? McNews everything. Not just USA Today. All papers. Shorter stories. Smaller words. Bigger pictures. In color. Right? Because they knew the nation that they had helped to create through the policies that they supported and endorsed with the Republicanism that we've lived under for the last 30 years. So they've slit their own throats. They've eliminated the very people they need to read their paper, can't read their paper. It would be like General Motors lobbying to eliminate driver education from the schools. I mean, they're pretty damn stupid at GM. I don't think they're that stupid. But the newspapers have been that crazy stupid. And now we're in the last year of reading them. The first newspaper was published 404 years ago this year. And now we're going to be, in this year, reading these things for the last time. And boy, who's going to be the happiest when they're all gone? The people in power. Because I'm sorry, but Steve sitting in his underwear, blogging away, down in Redwood, that just ain't going to get it. That's not going to tell us about what's really going on in Afghanistan. So we're pretty doomed when it comes to this media. But hopefully out of it will rise up something else, something new. And frankly, I mean, the Bay Area here has been a great place for new ideas, new thinking, thinking outside the box. And I think somebody or somebodies will come along and realize a new form of media that's independent, nonprofit, worker-owned, cooperative, whatever. It'll take on a new form that will be manageable, that will be able to pay salaries and do its work. And I'll tell you, people will read those papers. They'll read your paper. They read it in Europe. They read the paper in Europe because it's got content. I mean, real content. But that's because the majority of funding in Europe for the daily paper is circulation. They decided that circulation should be the main source of funding, advertising secondary. Exact opposite in the U.S. Advertising comes first, and then circulation. Well, if you've made the decision to make your readers second to the advertising community, well, then you don't really have to give them something they're really going to want to spend 50 cents or a dollar on every day. Whereas in Europe, if you're going to spend a euro a day on a paper, you better be some damn good writing in there. You better be telling me something I don't know. I'm going to find out only by reading the paper. And I'm going to want to hold that in my hands while I'm reading it. And that's the way it is over there. And that's the sad way that it is here.
It's more of a question, I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you on all of that, but aside from the delivery system of the news, it's the content of the news. how quickly everyone found out that, you know, Kanye West had a temper tantrum on MTV. Now, how many people knew about, you know, Baucus's plan coming out on healthcare the same day? And what's going to have more impact on their lives? You watch the coverage of the Tea Party gatherings, and what was the coverage of all the war protests, which are twice as big and gone on twice as long? So, I mean, in a sense, I mean, they may have dug their own grave with the choices they made, but they're also making their choices editorially, you know, about what they cover that also is dooming them.
I agree. They're completely out of touch with the American people, but when you've got the David Remnicks of the New Yorker of this world endorsing this invasion of Iraq, you know, at what point do we as so-called liberals just say, I'm not putting up with this anymore? And take the New York Times and the New Yorker and these things off their pedestal and start thinking of new ways to get information, to get the truth. Because clearly these publications, these so-called liberal publications, remind me of the old saying that the liberal is the cop for the right. In other words, the liberal exists as close to center as possible to define the left so that everybody else over here that's truly left of center is cut off. So the liberal says, this is the liberal's position. But it's really a centrist, sometimes center-right position. And the right loves that because it keeps the political discourse, you know, like this instead of like this. And I've just noticed that just in my own career, my own life of putting these movies out, that some of the most vicious attacks really on me will come from so-called liberals. And that gets into another whole issue of class. And what I've, you know, witnessed in terms of here I am, somebody that comes from the working class, that comes from an auto town in the Midwest, who has only a high school education, and that just doesn't fit into the New Yorker view of the world that they want to create in their liberal minds. And
even though it's a great American story, that is a great American story.
You mean my story?
Yeah.
What's so great about it?
Well, I mean, it's the ideal, right? it's what everyone has always tried to sell us. You know, you pull yourself up by your own bootstraps,
oh, okay.
You make the most of what you got.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. I am a Horatio Alger poster boy, on that level, but any use of me in that manner is only to create the illusion that anybody can make it in this country. You too can succeed someday. You can be rich. You can. And I'm telling you, it works. You just saw, you know, some of the people who are with us live here, I think, just saw the movie today, right? So the little yipper dog that's just jumping up to the table, that's us, you know, thinking we're going to get a piece of the pie. They aren't going to get no piece of the pie. With the richest 1% now owning more financial wealth than the bottom 95% combined, there's pie on the table. The rich man wants 9 slices of that pie, and he'll leave 1 slice for the remaining 9 people to fight over themselves. That is not democracy. That should be called un-American. And we should not allow it.
If it was the healthcare companies, the healthcare industry that was kind of huddled in the back room worrying about sicko, who's in the back room now worrying about the release of capitalism?
Well, I already know the answer to that question.
Yes.
It was funny, last night somebody sent me a link to somebody, let's just say, in support of the investment bankers, has already in advance made a short film called Government-Run Capitalism, A Love Story. And they've put it up on the internet. Basically, their point being that it's the government that has caused this crash and this crisis because there's too much meddling in the affairs of of capitalism and capitalists. And I'm thinking, wow, this just gets better and better with each film, you know? I mean, you know, back with Fahrenheit, Karl Rove admitted that he sent somebody out on the street to get a bootleg of Fahrenheit so he could watch it, which, of course, is a felony, by the way. And they hired pollsters, and they did focus screenings with Fahrenheit to figure out what to do because they were very worried about it. And they did this in three cities, and they found out that about somewhere, I think, around 10% of women who had voted Republican in the past, after watching the film, decided not to vote for Bush's reelection. And they were mortified by this number because they knew the election was going to be decided very closely. We knew we were going to head to another close election. So they went back and started to plan on what to do to, again, to discredit or smear the film, tell lies about it, me, whatever. And of course, I told you the story of Sicko. But now here I am sitting here just days before it's going to have its, you know, New York and L.A. opening, and then it'll open nationwide in October. And I get a call today from someone who will remain unnamed, but a well-known, well-connected person around the Democratic Party, telling me to cool it on Senator Dodd. For those who haven't seen the film, who are listening to this on the radio, in my film, I show how Senator Dodd, the chairman of the banking committee in the Senate, who's supposed to regulate the banking industry, the mortgage industry, was getting sweetheart loans, very low interest loans, with no fees attached, deals that you and I can't get from Countrywide, the largest mortgage lender in the country. And he's supposed to be regulating them. Over $1 million worth of loans. And so I put that in the film, and people say, oh, you know, Mike, that's really new. He's going after Democrats. And of course, then I think, well, okay, anybody who says that hasn't followed my work, because I had two TV shows on during the Clinton administration called TV Nation and The Awful Truth. And each week, I would go after various Clintonites for the various things that they were doing. And in my book back in the 90s, Downsize This, I had a chapter called Bill Clinton, the Best Republican President We've Ever Had. And so I've always been there to try and keep an eye on whoever was in power, regardless what their party affiliation was. So I get this call today telling me to back off. You know, this is bad. I said, well, listen, I've no personal bone to pick with Senator Dodd. I just think this guy has had an approval rating recently as low as 24%. If you, the Democratic Party, don't tell him to not run next year for reelection, you're going to lose that seat. So we all suffer as a result of that. We don't need to lose a seat right now. We need every seat we can get, and you need to tell him, don't call me. Call him and say, for the good of the country, you shouldn't run for re-election. We're going to run a person who's going to win. But I could see today from this phone call and from this video that was put up online last night that the machine is already pumped up and running to fight me and fight this film. But that's okay because, you know, this... I'm more proud of this film than I think anything I've done. I put everything into it. It was the hardest film that I've had to make. I feel very privileged and honored to be able to have people see this. And I'm excited about what can happen because I've already seen some screenings around the country. It's a little scary when during certain parts of the movie, people get pretty angry I mean, I've seen people stand up and just shout at the screen during the film. There's a scene in there where a county in Pennsylvania has privatized the juvenile home. And the private company that runs the juvenile home starts giving kickbacks to the juvenile judges to send kids there because they get like $400 a day or whatever for every kid that is in the juvie. And the judges made off with like $2.5 million. Horrible. And I was in Pittsburgh the other night, and a man, a steel worker, literally rises halfway up out of his seat and shouts at the screen, "Shame! Shame!" I mean, it is a good thing that there aren't pitchforks and torches in the lobby of the movie theater. And I'm encouraging any cinema that shows this to please just stick to the Twizzlers and the Goobers, because people are going to come out of there ready to rumble. But that's what I want. Nonviolently, I want people to rumble. I want them to get this country back in our hands. We're the majority. 75% of the people of this country want universal health care and expect it. And damn it, let's go.
I've got one more question for Michael, so if you want to start lining up at microphones for questions, there's one there and there's one over there. And the last question is, over all the years that you've been putting out films, I'm guessing this is the most polarized society you've ever released one into. We barely, as the left and the right, you know, the teabaggers and the liberals and the left, we barely talk to each other. Do you fear that people who are going to go see your movie are the people that are already convinced anyway? What kind of impact can it have?
Oh, no. Actually, this is one of the wonderful things that I've been blessed with, is that I'm one of the few people on the left who've been able to cross over and have my work seen by a mass mainstream audience. My movies play in multiplexes and shopping malls, not in just the art houses. The fact that my movies aren't just for the church of the left means a great deal to me, and it also is why they go after me with such a vengeance, because they see my films connecting to such a mass audience. You know, I could name other people on the left, people I love and admire, but because they don't have a mass audience, they just don't go after them. They leave them alone. So it's because of the opposite of that, actually, because it reaches out to people who aren't the converted, that makes me want to keep doing this. Because, I mean, I'll tell you already with this movie, first of all, you know, the studio does this testing that they always do with the movies to try and figure out the demographic and all this as they do their advertising for it. And they have found more people who have said they vote Republican loving this movie than any other movie I've done before that. And that's in part because if there is one foreclosure every 7.5 seconds, as there is now in the United States, one every 7.5 seconds, that's cutting across party lines, trust me. That's Republican, Democrat, Independent. I don't ever vote. It's hitting everyone. And once people are put through that, and you see that in this film, you see the woman, the dead peasant's insurance thing, and I cut away to the George Bush commemorative plate on her mantle. This is a Republican who's invited me in, who's called me to ask for help. The videotape in the film that was sent in by a family, just randomly, I open up the mail one day, there's a videotape, I pop it in, and this family has filmed their own eviction. They won't leave their house, and so there are 7 policemen at the door with hammers and metal objects trying to bust through the door. And as you look at that door they're trying to bust through, you see 4 of those magnetic yellow ribbons that say "Support the Troops." The Wall Streeters and the people in power have now started to hurt their own, the people that have supported them so much in the last 30 years. And the fact that they would turn to me for help to be in this movie, or the people that are saying they're going to come to this movie now, that is a very positive thing. I feel really lucky that that has happened. And I think this film has the potential to reach actually more people across, farther across party lines than any film that I've done in these past 20 years.
All right. So. We're going to start taking some questions in just a moment. As a reminder to the audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, and tonight we're hosting Michael Moore in his latest film, Capitalism, A Love Story. I'm Angie Cuero, host of Live from the Left Coast on Green 960 and moderator for this evening in discussion with Michael Moore, an Academy Award-winning American filmmaker, author, and liberal political commentator. As we go to the audience for questions, I'm going to ask you, since we want to get in as many as we can, if you please ask your question, keep it very brief, and take your seat, and we'll get you an answer right away. Okay, I'm going to start with you.
And I'll be brief, too, so we can get as many in as possible.
Thank you for coming. And I'm a Harvard Business School and Kennedy School grad, so I've been initiated into the system that you attack as much as anyone here. But I agreed with a lot of the excesses you pointed out. What I didn't understand was the takeaway from the film. Are you saying that the majority of Americans prefer the security of Europe to the relative economic mobility of America? Or why not fix the system? Why not a greater focus on education, a greater focus on better regulation?
I think it's too late to fix this system. I think it's gotten so big and so out of control. There are too many things that are, quote, too big to fail. I think the greed level went so far. It's way beyond that sort of Mayberry thing that you alluded to of the economic mobility of Americans. Let me tell you something. There's the economic mobility. The only mobility people are thinking about right now, people listening to this show right now, if I were to ask you and them who are listening, how many of you are absolutely sure you're going to have that job you're in right now next year, that that job will be there? How many are absolutely sure that job is going to be there? I don't think you'd get a whole lot of hands raised here. People are filled with anxiety and fear. They don't know if they're next. It didn't have to be that way. It didn't have to go that way. But, you know, 100 years ago, there was a big debate about child labor. And well-meaning people said, you know, we don't need to get rid of child labor. We just need to regulate it. If we had safer factories and make sure the kids go to school, then it would be okay to have 10 and 12-year-olds working in the factory. Well, no, it isn't okay. And society decided that that system was evil, and it had to go. You can't regulate child labor. You can't regulate slavery. And you can't regulate a system that allows for the richest 1%, I'll say it again, to own and control more financial wealth than the bottom 95% combined. That is so out of control madness that the takeaway from the film is, and I'm not an economist, but just I'm using my own common sense here. Maybe you can help me with your Harvard business degree. Seriously, I mean, we need people like you. And I didn't show the statistics in the film, but the number one job that Harvard graduates have been taking in recent years, if you look at the whole thing they go into, finance, banks, Wall Street is number one. Our best minds have been going into this instead of helping us have our first bullet train that can get us from New York to L.A. in 10 hours, which the science exists for that. But why don't we have it? Or the cure for cancer, or you name anything that we need. Energy. We need you. We don't need you coming up with weird gambling schemes to lose our pension money. So all I'm asking for is an injection of democracy into our economy. You and I really don't have a say in how this economy is run anymore. And I think that that's what has to happen.
Okay, let's go over here.
Hi, my name's Peter Gisella, and I'm a Air Force medic, Vietnam Air veteran, and I joined the Air Force rather than being drafted. And my question is, when I came to California here 32 years ago, I considered myself a liberal, and then I got involved in politics and advocating for a National Youth Service Program to replace the Selective Service Program as a wake-up call to wake up the youth every year to think about what is democracy and what is civic engagement. And there was a bill in the Congress to do this. And in the process of challenging the possibility of a million youth getting involved in community service projects and my focus of a youth energy corps, I discovered that the liberals hated it as much as the conservatives, now for different reasons. But it seemed to me a program that would only cost a few million dollars to challenge youth every year to think about volunteering to do something.
He gets the idea here. Let's go ahead.
And it's a great idea. I'm opposed to anything that forces anybody to do anything, a draft of any nature, although I have proposed in the last year or so of bringing back Selective Service, the draft, but just for the children of the richest 5% of the country. Because if it's their kids that have to go, trust me, we won't be going into any wars. And if they actually do call for a war, it probably is really true. We're in trouble if they're willing to sacrifice their own kids. So that's the only draft I would favor.
Hi. My name is Paul Kangas. I'm a veteran from the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. You were probably involved in the Vietnam era period. And I'm wondering, what can you
Lottery do? Number 275 in the 1972 draft.
That's not my question. Oh. My question is, what can you do now to get us out of Afghanistan? Because it's like...
I just want to sit down with President Obama and talk to him. And I want to say to him, quietly, privately, dude, we are so in such bad shape in this country right now. We have so many problems to fix. The other shoes haven't dropped yet with the economy. The credit card debt collapse that's going to happen. Commercial real estate crash that's going to happen. I mean... anybody who thinks that we're through the woods here, absolutely no way. And I just want to say to him, you're just going to have to leave these countries immediately, bring the troops home immediately, apologize to them for what we've done, promise any kind of help and reparation that we should give them when they figure out what kind of country they want. But you can't deliver democracy through the barrel of a gun.
Anyhow, the part of the question that I forgot was October 7th, there's a march here in San Francisco against the war.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. I'm an economist, and on behalf of the discipline of economics, I apologize. The second thing I want to do is I'm going to ask all my students that I teach economics to watch your movie, because I think they learned more economics there than I was able to teach them.
Oh, well, thank you.
I think that your message is, and what I believe in, is to change competition to cooperation and selflessness and greed into care for others.
I'm going to ask you to move to your questions.
Yes, and also, and if I can say this, to change how we measure the success of our society from the GDP to the GNH, our gross national happiness, a happiness index. I don't need to see every night on the TV news what the Dow Jones did today, when they're not going to tell me how many people lost their homes today. They're not going to tell me how many people lost their jobs today. The priorities are all screwed up here. And thank you for offering to show it to your students.
So my question is... free to comment. You know, Iranians are out there right now asking what happened to my vote. What if, and what's going to happen if the 75% that you mentioned go out and say, what happened to my money, what happened to my house, and what happened to my pension? Thank you.
Well, I don't know what will happen, but I'd like to see what would happen. And I got to tell you, there's a tipping point somewhere down the road. And the unimaginable can happen. I mean, who in here thought Mandela would ever be let out of prison let alone become president of South Africa? Seriously, be honest, if you're old enough, right? How many of you thought the Berlin Wall would come down in your lifetime? Not me. If I'd sat up here 3 years ago and told you that, hey, you know, in 3 years we're going to elect a black guy as president of the United States, you'd look at me like I was nuts. Crazy good things happen when people come together and coalesce in ways that we can't even predict. So I am hopeful that if we do this, if the 75% majority will come out there and do that, that we'll be in better shape.
My name is Shelvin, and I used to work for Smith Barney before, and so I actually left there because I agree with everything that you pointed out in your movie. But my question is, are you looking for interns? I understand that you work by yourself.
Interns?
Or assistants, you know, whichever one comes first.
You know, the thing with interns is it's a form of, again, legalized slavery. And so actually we have interns, but we pay our interns.
Well, Smith Barney wasn't any better than institutionalized slavery.
Yeah. Well, anyways, yes. But if you were to come to work for me, you'd have full medical and dental, no deductible, as many sick days off as you need, any personal days you need, all paid for. If you become pregnant, your maternity leave will not only be in all the science magazines, but we pay your full salary during your maternity leave. So,
thank you for your movie. I can't wait for it to catch fire all over the country. Two things about the movie confuse me. You focus on the excess, on the greed, on the deregulation of the recent decades, but you're not really criticizing the capitalist system in the movie, as I understood it. You're not criticizing the corporate entity as a legal privileged entity. You're not criticizing the stock market, per se. So if you could clarify that. And the second thing that confused me was at the very end you're saying, let's replace capitalism with democracy. Democracy is a political system, not an economic system. So what are you actually proposing to replace capitalism with? Thanks.
Let me put it this way. Capitalism has become a political system. Capitalism and the need to invade a country for its oil. Is that economics? Or is that politics? I guess it's both, isn't it? And democracy, I'm just saying democratic principles need to be applied to all aspects of our lives. That means our economy. That means the workplace. Every day we go to work for 8 to 10 hours a day, and it's a dictatorship. It's a totalitarian state. And that isn't right. You know, 100 years ago, marriage had a different definition. You had to ask for the woman's hand to her father, and then you as the husband were in charge, and you made all the decisions, and legally, women who were married could not own property. And then along came the women's movement and said, you know what? We need some democracy in what we call marital relationships. And that was a good thing, wasn't it? Because we were living that part of our lives, our relationships, in a non-democratic fashion. What's wrong with democracy in terms of applying it to any aspect of our lives, including the economy, the new economy we need to build? I want to get out of this paradigm, this old, boring paradigm of capitalism versus socialism. We're in the 21st century. Aren't we smart enough to come up with an economic model that speaks to the world that we live in today? And all I ask for when the economists get together and come up with this is that it have democratic principles involved and it have a moral core to it that says that the poor shall not be left alone and it shall not be punished, and that we behave the way I was taught by those nuns. We behave as if we're going to be judged by how we treat the least among us. If that's too much to ask in our economy, then I don't know what to do at this point, because I don't really want to go live in a cave. So,
I'm Stefan Tomic. I think it's nice that you pay your intern a good salary, but after watching your film, I would have expected that you share the revenue that you make out of the film with each of your interns and the non-English-speaking camera crews and everybody else involved in the film. So
he's saying that after watching the film, he is wondering, have I thought about sharing the economic resources of the film?
Revenue from the film.
The revenue from the film.
Yeah. Revenue, right?
Yeah. While I was making this film, and you see this in the film where I go and look at worker-owned businesses, where the businesses are actually owned by the workers, and it's a democracy there in the workplace. It really did get me thinking about that very question. And so I'm exploring how to do a film, perhaps the next film, as a worker-owned film, where I am one vote of the many votes that will make this film. Not creatively. I don't think art, you can't obviously have democracy when, I mean, if you're the painter, I mean, that painting's got to be expression of whatever, you know, whatever artistic thing is in you. But as far as the business part of it, the hours that are set, the money that gets paid, the benefits that exist, I love the idea of doing that with my crew. And so I am exploring that. And thank you for asking.
I'm curious to see it.
Yeah. So
this will be our
I.
last question here.
Yeah, and you're pointing at various banks and calling attention to their deeds. I'm sort of curious as to whether you purposely omitted talking about the Federal Reserve, and if so, why? Because
yes.
I saw the quotes that you had in the credits.
Yes, yes, I did, because I don't believe movies should be longer than 2 hours. I mean, really, yeah, I think you should have to get special dispensation from some pope of Hollywood if you're going to make a three-hour movie. And there's some great three-hour movies, so don't get me wrong. But seriously, 90 to 120 minutes is long enough to sit in a movie theater. So, yes, there needs to be a whole other film made on the Fed. There needs to be a whole other film made on the credit card industry. I had a whole section that I couldn't fit into the film because it was going to be too long. Just like in Sicko, I had to make the decision to focus on the health insurance companies. So I didn't really deal with the pharmaceutical companies. I think we'd all agree that a documentary on the pharmaceutical companies is something that's needed. So, so yes. And if you're the person to make that film, actually, I encourage you to do that.
Yeah. Actually, I was waiting with sort of bated breath because everything that I've looked into in the last year indicates, wow, I knew nothing about how our actual economy worked. And I thought, wow, I thought for sure you'd be getting more into that.
You were waiting with bated breath to see if I would go in and cover the Fed?
Well,
you know, usually at a movie, people are waiting with bated breath to see if the guy gets the girl or vice versa. You just walked out of the theater going, damn, he didn't get to the Fed. What kind of movie was this?
As we close up for tonight, are you going to send a copy to Barack Obama?
Well, my agent in Hollywood is a man by the name of Ari Emanuel. And
okay.
His brother has, I believe, a night job at the White House. And I'm hoping that he is able to have us over one day for a couple of hours so I could share it with him. There are scenes actually in that movie when I was making it. I thought, you know, this will be seen by millions, but I'm really making this particular scene for an audience of one because I so want him to be everything that he promised us he would be last year. And I'm holding out hope that that's the case. And I would hope that seeing my movie would encourage him to side with the people and not with Wall Street.
Say thanks to Michael Moore for tonight.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And this meeting of the Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.